But maybe you have some questions so far. We've talked about, yeah.
Just on that first, why emphasize aged mothers and not infants and handmaidens?
Okay, so why emphasize aged mothers and handmaidens rather than just sentient beings? Okay, think of your mother when she's aged. Your mom is getting old.
79 tomorrow.
She'll be what?
79
tomorrow. Okay. So when our mothers reach old age, they are more suffering, don't they? Yeah, they suffer a lot more because the body's breaking down. Society tends to ignore them. You know, they have much more suffering. And yet they're our mothers, and our mothers have been kind to us and raised us. Yeah, again and again with so much love and gave up so much of their own happiness for us. Yeah, and here they are aged. And especially, you know, what breaks my heart the most about my own mom is there's no interest in spiritual practice. And so facing old age and sickness and death without spiritual practice, yeah. So then when you think of your aged mother like that and her misery, then more compassion comes in the heart. Okay? So that's why it says aged mother sentient beings. Yeah? Because the mother part emphasizes our close connection. Yeah? The aged emphasizes her misery. So then we're more likely to take more interest and responsibility. Yeah.
Just a couple of questions about the terminology.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You talked about cognitive obscuration.
Mm-hmm.
And you also talked about non-abiding nirvana.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm wondering is, what are the cognitive obscurations? And also non-abiding nirvana is the same thing as non-dual.
Okay, so the first question was cognitive obscurations, what are they?
Yeah.
Right? Okay, so we have to start with the afflictive obscurations first, because we have gross afflictions, ignorance, anger, attachment, laziness, jealousy, pride, arrogance, belligerence, contempt, all 84,000, okay? And we have the seeds of those afflictions, which is like when the afflictions are not manifest in our mind, the potential is still in our mind for them to manifest again. So I'm not angry right now, but the seed of the anger is still with my mind stream. And thus, you know, all you have to do is give me the most minor thing and I'll be manifestly angry again. Okay? So the afflictions and their seeds, and then the karma, all the actions that we do and the karmic imprints created under their influence, those are the afflictive obscurations. When we remove those, we attain arhatship. The afflictive obscurations are said to be like onions. Okay, you cook onions in a pot. They're kind of stinky. You take out the onions. So the onions aren't there, but the smell remains. Okay, so the onions are like the afflictive obscurations. The smell of the onions are the cognitive obscurations. So even in our hardship, we may have removed the afflictions and their seeds and the karma from our minds. But there's subtle latencies left that are like the smell. So these are subtle latencies that produce the appearance of inherent existence. So still, you know, the mind, an arhat cannot see ultimate and conventional truth simultaneously due to these subtle obscurations in the appearance of inherent existence. So because of not seeing you know, all conventional ultimate phenomena simultaneously, and Arhat's abilities to be of benefit and their psychic powers and so forth are limited. They aren't the same as those of the Buddha. Okay? Then you asked about non-abiding nirvana and if that was the same as non-duality. No. Okay? Non-duality refers to emptiness. Okay? There's actually many different meanings of non-duality, but, you know, the primary one is the lack of inherent existence. Yeah? Now, it's perceiving the lack of inherent existence directly that leads us to eliminate the afflictive obscurations. And it's removing the afflictive obscurations which will enable us to attain nirvana. It's continuing to purify our mind by means of meditating on non-duality, by meditating with the wisdom realizing emptiness directly. And that enables us also to remove the cognitive obscurations, at which point we attain the enlightenment of a Buddha, which is called non-abiding nirvana, because we don't abide in samsara and we don't abide in the nirvana of an arhat, which is self-complacent peace. Okay, got it? Okay. Yeah.
When it comes to the bodhisattvas, my understanding is they're omniscient but not omnipotent.
Okay. So you're asking about bodhisattvas. That you're thinking that they're omniscient, but they're not omnipotent. Actually, the bodhisattvas are neither. Okay? Because bodhisattvas are Buddhas in training. So they still have defilements on their minds. So they're not omniscient. Only a Buddha is fully omniscient. Okay? Now, a Buddha is omniscient but not omnipotent. Okay? Because a Buddha, from the side of a Buddha, they've eliminated all their own hindrances to being of benefit to others. But they can't just wish something and make it happen because they have to work within what our karma will allow. So they're not omnipotent, because if a Buddha could have eliminated all of our suffering by now, there are many Buddhas and they would have done that already, because the Buddhas say there is absolutely no good reason for sentient beings to continue to suffer if there's a way for them not to suffer. Okay? So from the side of the Buddhas, you know, it's not that, you know, it's a very different paradigm than that of a creator God. Yeah, because the Buddhas did not create samsara, they did not create suffering, they are not saying that you suffer so that you can learn something, you know. We don't have to please the Buddhas in order for our suffering to stop. Yeah, they aren't controllers and managers of the universe. But the Buddhas, from their side, have eliminated their hindrances to benefit us. But we still have all of our karmic obstacles and all of our resistance. Okay? So every time we watch resistance arise in our mind, we should identify this as, now I'm creating problems for the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Because my resistance isn't letting them help me. Yeah? So it's not, you know, because we can really get into our resistance sometimes, can't we? It's like, you know, we put up those walls and don't tell me what to do and don't do this and don't do that. And, you know, our famous one is, you're pushing me. Yeah? You're pushing me, I can't do that. Yeah? Dharma's making me suffer. cut it out. Dharma's not making us suffer. Our afflictions are making us suffer. Okay, our spiritual teacher is not making us suffer. Our afflictions are making us suffer. Okay? But we get it all confused. We put up the walls and, you know, then here's Chenrezig, you know, trying so hard to benefit us, and we're going, okay, so that's why they're not omnipotent. Because the force of our karma, the force of our afflictions, of our resistance is strong.
That's why I was begging the question, like, I'm grateful they stick around to offer the help they can.
Yeah, we should be really grateful. Yeah. And that's why we do purification practices, and that's why we do practices of creating positive potential. And that's why we listen and contemplate and meditate on the Dharma, because all those activities are what eliminates our resistance. Okay? And enables the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas to benefit us more. It's like a doctor, you know, if a patient comes in and the patient doesn't know very much, they're terrified, and the doctor says, you know, stop smoking and stop drinking and get some exercise, and the patient goes, ah, I don't want to, that's too hard, you're pushing me, you know. I talked to Peter Hahn, who, you know, he used to come to retreats a lot. He told me that his patients, because he's a doctor, you know, he tells them, you know, get more exercise, eat more healthier, stop smoking, stop drinking. They have a little, it's too hard, you know. So, in the analogy, you can see the patients are resisting the efforts of the doctor to help. Yeah? But when the patients get more education, yeah, when they understand why smoking is harmful to their health, when they understand why drinking is harmful to their well-being, when they understand why exercise is good for them, yeah, then through this education, then they might start doing it. When they start doing it, then they see the results. Yeah. So it's the same with us. When we hear the teachings, our mind begins to change. And then if we start practicing the teachings by purifying and collecting positive potential and studying and practicing them in more depth, our mind changes and we begin to cooperate more with the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. Okay? Yeah, this will be the last question.
I was heard somebody referred to the habits of mind.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in conditioning or something. Would mm-hmm. that be like afflictions?
Ah, okay. So habits of mind, meaning conditioning. So is that like afflictions? It's related to afflictions, but it's not exactly the same. Okay? Because afflictions are active consciousnesses, and habits are, you know, habituated, you know, a habit is slightly different than a consciousness. A habit is a tendency to do something again and again. So we do have a strong habit with afflictions. Okay? Because anger rises very habitually, doesn't it? Yeah, push button. Somebody criticizing me, I get angry. Yeah, we have a habit with anger. We have a habit with attachment. I see something attractive, whoop, there's attachment. Mm-hmm.
What about beliefs?
What about beliefs? We are also habituated to many beliefs. And this is why afflictive views is also included as one of the big categories of the root afflictions. Is we have all sorts of wrong beliefs, and we're very well habituated with them, we're very well conditioned by them, and they completely limit us. They're like, you know, our wrong views are just keep us trapped, and we believe in them so tenaciously. Yeah. I mean, look, if you, we just look in the world, we look at somebody else's wrong view. The wrong view that if you kill people who you think are hostile to your religion, that you're going to go to heaven. That's a pretty wrong view, isn't it? Okay? Lots of people have it. It causes suffering to others. It causes suffering to those people. But it's very difficult for them to disengage from that when they've had a lot of conditioning and a lot of social support for that view. So it's very easy to see other people's afflicted views. Our own afflicted views are much more difficult to see because we think they're true, just as other people believe their afflicted views are true and can't see them as incorrect. We believe ours are true, and somebody tries to correct our afflicted views and we fight that person. Yeah? And we say, you're wrong. Okay? But it's quite interesting, you know, if you look again in the Pali Sutras, the Buddha was so amazing in his life, you know, how he just talked to everybody. And so many of the people that he talked to were people who had incredible wrong views. Yeah, because it was a very philosophically rich time in India when the Buddha lived. You had the Brahmins who had their views. Then you had all sorts of wandering ascetics, and each group had their own view, you know, about what was samsara, what was the path, what was liberation. And the Buddha talked to all of these people. Yeah. And he tried to help them really, you know, become clear from their wrong views. And some of them saw that and joined the Sangha, and other ones continued to have their afflicted views. Yeah. There's a whole sutra called the Brahma Jala, the Brahma Net Sutra, where the Buddha talks about, I think it's 62 wrong views. Maybe it's 64. But, you know, you can... He kind of, those were the popular ones at his time. But then if you synthesize those wrong views, you come up with ones that are very similar to wrong views people have nowadays. Yeah. So you see, you know, same old, just slightly different variety. Yeah, but some very basic principles in there. Okay, so let's say quietly.